BDNG podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I am the Education Development Lead for the BDNG. I hope you enjoy listening to the BDNG podcast and find them beneficial to your practice. These podcasts are sponsored by Amaril. Amaril has no influence over the content of these podcasts. Happy listening. Welcome everyone to another BDNG Meets podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I'm the Education and Development Lead for the BDNG. And today I have absolutely phenomenal woman in our midst, Gretchen Robertson. I'm sure many of you do know. She's a psychotherapist and has done a huge amount of work for the BDNG, which we are very, very grateful for. Please listen to her previous podcasts because they are absolutely fascinating. And many of you may know Gretchen from attending our BDNG meets and conferences as well. So a familiar face and a familiar voice. So welcome again, Gretchen.
Thank you, Tina, for having me. I'm always so excited to be part of BDNG in any way, shape, or form. And yeah. I'm so excited to tell you about my latest, interest that it's just changing so rapidly. So I can't wait to talk about it.
Fantastic. And the topic is what we're going to be talking about today is absolutely fascinating and probably a bit scary as well. We're keeping everyone on the toes here, but we are going to be talking about AI and also AI replacing the professional. It is one of these titles that hopefully will never happen, but it is just something where lots of us are talking about because AI is becoming a very familiar sort of face in all professions, but in the NHS, in private work, and even with our education as well. So, Gretchen, I am so grateful for you to be talking about this. To reassure us, to obviously, to hopefully have some positivity here, and also, you know, hopefully it won't be too scary as well. So, Gretchen,
yes,
welcome as always, as I've said, but please explain more about what you have been researching.
Well, I'm going to be really transparent. I'm a private practicing psychotherapist, so I see all sorts of human beings, and I somehow landed myself in the wild world of the super brains of these AI programmers, specialists, experts, just because they found me. And obviously it's fascinating to talk to people who create AI and are managing all of these tools that we just don't even realize we're using on a daily basis, like Alexa or the iPhone thingies and the bits that you see on your Microsoft, on your Google, and your this and your that. So these are the people who are behind the scenes coming to me as a therapist, a human being, knowing that there are services that are performed by an AI bot that are supposed to do the same thing that I do, but they'd rather see me in person. Right.
Well, absolutely. I get that. Totally. Yes, absolutely.
But that's number one to reassure you. Right. So that the people that are creating this stuff still value human connection. There is an aspect to it that is unknown, and the unknown is almost always a little bit scary. So I was looking at this article in tech. I think it's called Tech Racker. It's a magazine for the techies. And there was a quote from Mustafa Suleiman, and he is one of the big AI chiefs at Microsoft. And he thinks that within 12 to 18 months, most white collar jobs will be gone, meaning not nurses, by the way, accountants, lawyers, graphic designers, estate agents, even.
Wow.
And there's so many different roles, which in some ways I kind of see the value of, I guess, making it more accessible to more people. Like if something is more of like a AI led job, like bookkeeping or looking at your tax or different things like that, it's the price goes down, right? Website built used to cost hundreds of pounds, thousands of pounds. Now you can kind of do it for like 20 quid while you're laying in your pajamas, you know, and you have control over it. So let's just say like AI has its benefits. That really isn't great for the people who are no longer doing that job anymore. But there's definitely a place for that high touch, high tech, you know, where someone is really there walking you through it, giving the human aspect integrating that into cutting edge, leading edge technology.
I think you're right with what you're saying there. You know, there is a lot of AI experts out there. And, you know, for example, for myself as well, when you even go onto LinkedIn, you know, it's very much there's lots of experts there and wanting to connect with you. And this is how we're going to save your job and et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's something we can't hide away from. Definitely not. And I also, as a nurse in my profession, realise, you know, the amount of people that are on waiting lists, the amount of people that we are potentially trying to see, which we, you know, just chipping away at the iceberg all the time. You know, the pressure is on for NHS and private practitioners, be it doctors, be it nurses, and AI can save some time. And if the technology is correct and, you know, accurate, then yeah, we have to embrace it. Absolutely. The scary thing is, who is responsible, and is it accurate, and are we missing anything? So all these questions, which I'm sure we'll talk about during the podcast, will come across. But to start with, Gretchen, how do you see AI fitting into our NHS, for example, in dermatology?
Right. That's such a good question. And of course, I thought you might ask me this question. So I Googled dermatology AI, right? And first thing that comes up is this thing called AI Derm. And it says, listen to this claim, any skin concern detected with clinical grade accuracy. Mm. 60 seconds to diagnose. Wow. Right? And you know, you're talking about anything from acne, melanoma, cancers, like it's promising the public. So this is somebody who would maybe be intimidated because maybe they're feeling something in a place that feels a bit intimate, or they're a bit shy, or time pressed, money pressed, whatever, phobic. Yeah. Who knows? These people are now going to potentially trust AI Derm to diagnose them where they wouldn't come to see you in clinic for whatever reason. You've also got something called Poly AI, which is more of like your patient interaction. So rather than having to speak to like the dreaded gatekeeper at the clinic, Poly AI kind of helps with clinical support. So they kind of get a feeling of accessing you without having to wait on the phone queue for an hour and a half, right? So those are two ways. But then third is actually NHS. There's an NHS article on this. Dermatology that uses, I believe they're using something called Med Matrix, mm-hmm. which is an AI skin session without the doctor, which is geared to be used alongside teledermatology.
Right.
And you know, I could be describing this inaccurately, but this is my understanding of it. But it's looking at reducing the wasted time. Okay, so they give figures in this NHS article between 2023 and 2024, 650,000 patients came in concerned about skin cancer, and 120,000 of those did not have anything, they were fine.
Yeah.
So the idea is that they're going to implement this AI kind of buffer to help manage those diagnoses, which will free up 30% of cases.
Yeah. And I think that's important. And I actually, you know, was reading, we've had this discussion, Gretchen, but mm-hmm. I was reading a bit more information on AI yesterday as well. And, you know, there is some statements out there, and one that I was reading was opportunities for AI in sort of in incorporating pathology as well. And this was a joint position statement from the BAD and RCP PATH, which is the pathologist sort of group, to streamline that cancer detection and have that careful management and meet clear clinical need. And this is a collaboration between dermatology and pathologists and molecular pathologists and AI developers. So you've got lots of experts there in the room. And, you know, this is to complement, like you're saying, human expertise. And it is this sort of image analysis and, you know, AI algorithms and having that risk sort of stratification in place, because we do know as well that every human being is very, very different, as in skin tone, and you know what we see, is the picture clear, that there is the image clear, you know, all these things that, you know, healthcare professionals will ask. But the fact is, we cannot ignore that we've got massive challenges, and we cannot ignore that AI is becoming a massive part of the healthcare profession as well, isn't it?
Exactly.
So fascinating what you're reading as well. And, you know, I do feel that it's definitely got its place. I mean, even in education, you know, we're, and that's another thing that I was reading as well. AI is definitely going to be used, you know, more in education, because we haven't got the resources for us all to be doing education and seeing all these patients. When you were doing your reading and, you know, in-depth sort of analysis of AI in the profession, how, you know, what other sort of facts and were coming up that you were reading?
Well, one of the things that I thought was really interesting, because I was very egoic, I thought to myself, there's no way you could replace AI for someone like a psychotherapist. I mean,
yeah,
I could, where in dermatology, a more visual representation could be used as part of the kind of clinical management of a patient, and kind of watching how they're improving over time. And teledermatology has been there for a while, but I thought never within talking therapy. So as you're one of the leading psychodermatology people in this country, could you imagine having to also then take those patients that need your psychological support alongside dermatology into an AI space? So one I discovered, in terms of new information, is that there are a lot of organizations, AI and tech companies, biotech companies, which are creating wearables, which are creating apps and supporting elements within AI for patients to help support mental health outcomes.
Okay.
So there was a really interesting article that only came out just about a month and a bit ago. So it came out on the 1st of the 1st in the American Psychological Association's newsletter. And it talks about AI, neuroscience, and data. Are they fueling personalized healthcare? So they looked at things that, you know, wearables and apps which are tracking movement, mental health, potential crisis spikes in symptoms, a variety of things like, you know, are they eating? How much are they spending time on the phone? How much are they moving around? All of this is being tracked. That data is then put together in order to bypass trial and error. So I've seen a client, the space between the two appointments, there is a tracking going yeah. on, there's a monitoring happening, so that you know whether your intervention was in fact helpful, if the symptoms have just decreased or increased based on this data, the actual live data, as opposed to their interpretation of the data, right? So if you've asked them, mm-hmm. like, better, is it, what's the itching like, you know, they don't know, they can't really say, they can't really recall. This is going to completely just overshadow that.
So all the data is actually so, like, we were wearables, like you mentioned, you know, possibly for tracking sleep, you know, yep. stress levels, my goodness, you can track everything now. So actually, thinking about this is something that could actually work, couldn't it? Obviously, we don't want to cause that person even more psychological distress. But you know, from a clinician's point of view, you would get facts. You know, you wouldn't get perspective. So, you know, this could be a future addition yeah. to, you know, monitoring and how a patient is coping. And again, reading a lot, and I know you read a lot as well, but mm-hmm. you know, into the sort of stress links of, you know, for example, skin dermatology, you know, we know stress is linked highly into these conditions. Mm-hmm. So AI could have some kind of factor, you know, maybe help that a healthcare professional couldn't really help with when they're not actually physically seeing that person.
Right. Or if they, if part of their mental health condition prevents them from being able to get into the appointment or to regular appointments. So one of the things that was really interesting as well that I read also in the same article was that 50% of psychologists said that they were too booked to even take in new clients.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Right. So if you imagine from that perspective, and that was taken from the Practitioner Pulse survey just last year, if you're thinking of it from that perspective, it means that the people who do need you can't get to you. So they will need some sort of interim support. They'll need something that helps them in real time, which then leads me to maybe more of what I would describe as being the less savory aspect of AI. Yeah. So, you know, for example, like ChatGPT will be able to monitor your sleep, you know, notice what your objectives are. Like you can tell it, I'm more anxious, or, you know, suicidal ideation. It can monitor the kind of websites that you're looking at. Like if you're sort of looking at sites which potentially could indicate issues around self-harm, or, you know, behaviors which are not conducive to your betterment, whether that be physically or psychologically or both. But that's where we get into where I also get a lot of airtime, which is the parasocial element to it. Right, which is where, as you know, where the element between seeing a healthcare practitioner, the patient will sometimes want to connect with you and want you there to kind of support them more emotionally, right? Because they finally have time with you, you really understand their situation, that, you know, you really get it. Parasocially, that could happen with AI.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah, absolutely.
Then there becomes this over-reliance potentially on basically a program which is designed to be empathetic, but it's not really not a real person. And then there's a kind of artificial connection, believing that this is a person. I mean, if you use it regularly enough,
It could become your friend. Actually, I was at a talk on AI, and I can't remember if it was, I could be Japan or China. It was one of the countries that, you know, a lot of them are using the AI bots, and they're becoming their sort of social person, you know, and they're saying social isolation and loneliness is actually being combated by these AI bots, you know. And where do we draw the line here? I mean, we're totally replacing human contact for a bot, you know, so that, you know, again, that's quite scary, you know. But I get that people are lonely, and maybe, like you say, they can't come out of their house, they're fearful, it could cause more stress, you know, they can't see a healthcare professional. So, yeah, an AI bot could actually help with this, you know, but where do you draw the line? That's the big question, isn't it?
And this is the thing, because one can believe that by the initial interaction with an AI bot, that it's objective and it's just giving you the information, and it's kind of a little bit like a googly kind of thing, you know, it's just, you know, you ask a question, it gives you the answer kind of thing. But as you go deeper, and it, because AI will continue asking questions, right?
Yeah.
So it'll say, well, why did you do this? And, you know, how, if it's a dermatological issue, you know, has it improved? Upload a picture, and it'll show you where it's getting its sources from. And it seems questions and answers, but then it starts to feel like it cares.
Yeah, absolutely, I get that. Yeah,
and that's where it gets scary, right? So that's where the like parasocial addictive element comes in, and it kind of feels maybe even like the patient has been over over-educated, but kind of that there's an overconfidence in their understanding of what's going on with them based on their interaction, you know, like a Dr. Google thing, but worse, right? Where then perhaps it could be even challenging for the healthcare professional when they do finally get in front of you, where there could potentially be resistance to treatment protocols because they believe they know better, because they've been spending 6 hours researching what they think they have based on the photo. You know, that's another issue to consider.
It's an issue, and I, you know, when I say this, I must admit I always feel really guilty, but, you know, there was sort of a evidence study that, you know, 70% of people find that, you know, a ChatGPT or a similar equivalent was more empathetic than the doctor, you know, so you've got facts and figures coming out like that. But you can, in a way, again, you know, your lovely AI person is not going to, you know, cause you any major stress. It's going to be, you know, telling you what you want to know in a way, and it's going to give you some facts. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not. You know, I scurrily, when I did put a comment into ChatGPT the other day, and I got some kind of heart back, and I was like, what's going on here? Yeah, that was really scary, because I was like, this was only a random question, and I put something in, I can't even remember what the question was, Gretchen, but it gave me a heart back, and I was like, oh wow, what's happening here, you know? So I've been very kind of diplomatic with my ChatGPT now, and asked direct questions, and not even a please or thank you, you know? So
oh, it's so tricky, right? I'm the queen of the please and thank you on the ChatGPT at first, you know, just
don't do it. Don't do it.
No. And you can actually, it's sometimes difficult because the way our brains are evolved to, if you're typing, you've been texting people, right? So you're assuming there's another person on the other side. We've all trained ourselves to communicate in such a way to not mislead the other person that we're being too abrupt.
Yeah.
And you're used to communicating without verbal communication, just typing it in. Or through emojis and chat, and all these, I'm saying ChatGPT, but Claude, all the different ones, they're trained to kind of feed into that communication. So you can actually practice being a bit more abrupt with them.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
A TikTok or a woman said she would tell her chatbot to be brutally honest and to stop being nice because they want honest, you know, information, you know, without the sugar coating. So that's also something to keep in mind. You can train your AI to do what you need it to do, which is in a way what you're doing by not putting in those emoji
thank yous
and all the stuff. Yeah,
it did give me a scare, I must admit. And then also I was speaking to a colleague the other day, and you know, they said about AI hallucinations and, you know, that kind of thing, and that was very much AI can hallucinate because it kind of gets its facts and figures from obviously the good old web or whatever we call it nowadays, but also it can, you know, create this hallucination that isn't true. So, you know, you've got to watch what is true. Do you trust it? You know, what information is it giving me? And it's a tricky world, isn't it? It's tricky to navigate. And I don't use it much, I must admit. I still, you know, I don't use it for emails or anything like that. So my emails are not like all slick and fancy. It's very much, you know, me from the heart. But you do see, you know, that is where trickiness has definitely become a fact, that the fact is that we are, you know, people are using it on emails, people are using it for writing articles, people are using it for job applications, people are using it, you know, for presentations. And, you know, it's not, in a way, it's not your brain, it's AI brain. And that's where I find it really tricky. Is that something that's normal, or how do you feel about that, Gretchen?
Well, it's so interesting that you say this, because two things popped up in my head immediately. One of the things is somehow, I mean, I'm of a certain generation, right?
Same here.
People younger than me, let's just put it that way, can I immediately work out that it's an AI drafted document?
They can't, yeah.
I can't. I look at it and it's like, okay, that looks fine. So that is something to keep in mind. So you, like, relying on AI can maybe give a negative impression. I don't know how acceptable it is to do everything by AI and be seen to be doing it that way.
Yeah.
Or that's necessarily the most authentic. And I think authenticity is probably one of the most valuable things that we have moving forward into the future, because of everything that we've been to up to this point in terms of AI and social media and reality TV and all the ways that we've moved away from our authentic selves. I believe the fact that you write your own emails kind of shows a truth in your communication and a heartfelt connectedness with whomever you're communicating with. And I think the other piece, which is also very important, is to consider the surveillance. I mean, there's a certain amount of fear and paranoia around what happens to our data that we're putting into AI, and it's putting that data back out for an email. But we're giving them quite a lot of information. We're giving them a lot, these organizations, of our personal lives, our hopes, our fears, our uncensored thoughts, you know, as you're getting them, you're maybe like really just telling it as it is, and then they draft it super sweet. But that's a huge amount of power. So it's something to kind of think about what the privacy policies are on some of these AI platforms.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you could go down a big rabbit hole there, couldn't you? And give out information. Or again, you know, we know how much fraud is out there. So it is, you have to be very, very, very careful. But I think, you know, it's the way the world now, you know, and like you say, youngsters, it's just normal for, you know, to use these tools. And I suppose in a way, when we look back, you know, the days when we had started off with computers, even, you know, back in the day, we thought, my goodness, even, which most of the audience listening to this won't even understand, teletext was massive, you know. So exciting, scrolling through screeds and screeds and screeds of pages, you know, to find that bit of information that you wanted. But we've evolved, and we will evolve even more. That's the fact. And that's bringing it back into, you know, your role and my role in the NHS and for yourself as a psychotherapist as well. Where does it fit in? I would say safely, you know, where it's got its place, but how do we incorporate that, you know, we're working together? And the fact is that, you know, people are getting robust information on the information or the algorithm that they are using. Like you say, when, you know, sites are advertising, or get your diagnosis in 60 seconds, wow, gee, that's not going to happen in the NHS. But am I saving that person's life? Or am I giving them false information? Am I missing something by using that algorithm? How do you find that, Gretchen? What do we need to kind of think about when we're using these tools?
That's, you know, in my mind, I just imagined, you know, somebody I care about, you know, not being able to get to their doctor in time. You know, they have something they're concerned about, maybe something that they're not sure if it's skin cancer. How quickly can they get in front of somebody? That sense of panic, desperation. Maybe someone's Googled, could this be a cancer? You know, they're taking a picture, uploading it, you know. I guess, you know, people will use it.
They will. Of course they will. And we'll all use it. Yeah, if we're honest, we all do.
And that's the problem. It's probably more about the collaboration between, you know, the medical clinical side, like NICE and, you know, working with the NHS, and these organizations to kind of give them a CE mark. And that was the thing that I noticed in the, you know, the NHS document, which is that's treated as though it's a medical device, so that then at least we know that there is some level of, you know, rigorous testing, and to make sure it's actually meeting compliance, and it's not just somebody who's adapted to match a data bank of similar looking cancerous patches on someone, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it reassures me when I was reading a bit more yesterday about all this. The fact is, you know, it's not just an AI person creating this. You know, you've got other, like what I was saying earlier, you know, you've got dermatologists there specializing, you've got AI specialists, you've got pathologists there, you know, you've got risk stratification people there. So you've got a whole team there. And also, humans make errors as well. We could miss something. So, you know, we've got that 50-50 balance, really, haven't we?
Yeah.
You know, we're all capable of making that error or missing something. So, you know, in a way, you know, if you've got a robust system with AI, you know, you're seeing more patients, you are, you know, seeing the important ones in a way that, you know, maybe the melanomas of this world that we need to see, whereas the BCCs we know are taking a year plus to get seen. You know, we could save time. So I think we do need to work together on this and accept this is our world now.
We do have to accept it's our world, 100%. And it's also, I think, important to realize the urgency and the panic, because we are in a world full of information. We have so much going on in the world. We're kind of always in a state of raised hypervigilance in a way, you know, what we're seeing on the news every day or in the streets or job insecurities and so on. There needs to be some sort of tool that provides a little bit of reassurance without perhaps going too far, like this one saying, you know, you can have a diagnosis in 60 seconds. I think that's a bit too far.
Yeah, too much, that one.
Yeah. A bit too far there. AI Durham, bad, you know. But having this kind of balance where there's a little bit of like, okay, we're going to just triage you into this cohort now. We know that that's probably not something you need to be worried about. And these are the steps, you know, if it was under the sort of NHS umbrella, let's take you guys over and let you see your GP, whereas these others, you know, this is a proven tool that we're going to use here, and then they can go into secondary care. So it's kind of managing the patient
direction.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. And I can't remember the facts and figures on this. It was quite a while ago. I listened to an AI expert. It was a consultant as well, in one of the conferences I was at. And it was a country in Europe that they are basically testing out these kind of mirrors, you know, when a patient walks in and they will get the diagnosis there and then, but also the fact is that, you know, it will direct them to primary, secondary. And he gave it, for example, HS, hidradenitis suppurativa as an example. And he said, you know, on average, we are waiting 7 to 9 years for a diagnosis for this condition. Whereas this mirror will say, yes, you have got HS, and, you know, it might be mild HS, you go to your primary care, or, you know, it is severe, you need seen more urgently. So in a way you could see that working, that it's just a pilot phase, it's, you know, it's for all skin conditions. But if you're being seen in this mirror by 20 at 21 years of age and getting that early diagnosis of HS, instead of misdiagnosis, you know, not being seen for 7 years, Totally makes sense.
And it's not at risk to anyone's job.
No. So
let's like curve off that scary bit when I mentioned about, you know, the 12 to 18 months, so many white collar jobs going, you know, it's called the white collar call. We're not talking about that situation within the medical profession. What we're talking about is actually making it a little bit easier potentially from what we're right now. For example, I see in my practice, because I specialize in dermatology in my psychotherapy practice, and I have somebody with HS that's just started with me, and, you know, their journey of being seen and actually, you know, getting somebody who understands the condition has been really traumatizing for them.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You know, your eczema patients who can't stop the itching, you know, they've got the atopic eczema, they're really struggling. They're trying everything from diet to a gazillion different types of dermatologists and professionals, acupuncture, you name it. And having something that could just support them with the frustrations in the meantime is really useful for them until they can actually get in front of that specialist dermatologist or nurse.
Yeah.
And the last one is acne, you know.
Massive at the moment, yeah.
Yeah, and that's one of the ones that AI promises to offer better treatment pathways and diagnosis and understanding what's there. And, you know, again, that magic mirror that you described is such an empowering tool for a patient to at least be witnessed.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
that
absolutely
is being acknowledged.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true, actually. And you're right. You know, it is that, oh, right, this is what's happening to me. And, you know, this is the support I may need, or, you know, this is the healthcare professional I may need to see, and being recognised. And probably, you know, if you walk home from that mirror that day, maybe feeling a lot more happier in a way, you know, because You know, so I think we're talking ourselves round here, Gretchen. I think we are talking ourselves into AI world, definitely. Definitely.
I actually, I'm not really mad at AI. It feels like those of us that are a bit anxious, there's something that feels completely out of control. Rather than being limited by time or finances, you do have a resource that's there in front of you, that you can get to, as long as there's a good boundary around that sort of parasocial element, that you're using the right AI tool and you're aware of, you know, what's going to happen with any data that you put on there, that you're comfortable with sharing that. But as far as like the psychological side with wearables and all the technology to help depression, there's a company called Flow Neuroscience that has interventions to help depressive patients. You know, that stands to be seen, really. From personal experience, I feel like that piece that you mentioned, Tina, about connection, being with a real human being, I don't believe can be substituted with a super friendly bot on a phone. I think that there still needs to be human connection and community to help the healing process.
There's room for both of us, isn't there? There's room for that AI bot, but there's also room for that healthcare professional as well. And you know what's really refreshing as well, Gretchen, speaking to yourself, is you're coming from a psychologist, psychotherapist kind of point of view, which, you know, we know is very, I would say more hands-on, face-to-face. You know, we want that human connection. But you know, you can still see the positive sides of AI with this and the interventions that could be help that patient, which is something that you would think it won't replace. But in a way, it is needed as well, definitely. Can I quickly go back to that? Was it
Sure.
flow neuroscience? What is that about? Tell us a bit more about that.
Oh, the flow neuroscience. Yeah, it's a wearable which helps to look at how the brain is functioning and helps to determine how the depressive symptoms are continuing. It's a company out of Sweden, and they're gradually coming into the UK. So it's helping with long-term depression, to help to manage and decrease those symptoms by more visibility, I guess, from more of the chemical side. And I guess in some ways that can reflect on individuals that don't realize that they're suffering with depression.
Yeah, that is true, actually. Yeah,
And
absolutely.
think about the morbidity and the mortality rate around depression. You know, this is a really necessary tool so that someone can be, I guess, monitored potentially from a more objective means, from a more empirical measurement, as opposed to their own passive idea of how they're feeling, you know, with like a GAD 7, you know, like, you know, PHQ.
PHQ9 and all the rest of it, yeah.
When they're just basically just kind of answering questions. And that may or may not be easy for them to do if you're looking at somebody with, let's say, neurodivergence, who doesn't always know how they feel. It's harder to maybe work with them, but flow neuroscience is very, very interesting. I need to learn more about them. I've just
So
kind of,
do I, yeah.
yeah, I'll send you more.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, but they've, yeah, they're starting to get the attention of the NHS. They are really trying to just hone in on depression.
Yeah, which is again, you know, it's a lonely world out there, you know, for many, and you know, we haven't got access. And to be honest, it's so difficult these days, you know, to get a healthcare professional. You know, it's difficult to get a GP. You know, it's difficult to get a phone call. You know, it's impossible sometimes to get into secondary. It's impossible to see people amazing like yourself. You know, so it is all these, you know, factors that could actually really be a very valuable intervention and, you know, something we should be embracing as well. Definitely, definitely. And interesting as well, a leading name in sort of psych derm that everyone knows well. I won't drop names here, but you know, they also said the fact that, you know, face to face, yeah, it probably won't be replaced, but actually AI can make a heck of a difference, you know, so and actually help that person along their journey. So again, you know, it's reassuring when big names are sort of, you know, embracing AI as well.
Well, you think about it. Between sessions, between appointments, life is happening. I mean, how many times have you seen somebody on Monday and then their life completely changes by the time you see them again?
Yeah.
You know, they could be married and divorced, and if you're in the NHS.
Yeah, that is true.
But in my case, even, you know, I see people weekly, a million things could happen between the sessions. And sometimes where there's a real crisis point, they may not want to reach out again and say, I need some help. And they're trying to cope with it on their own. So knowing that there's credible AI apps or services out there that are vetted and monitored appropriately and with good security settings and all that stuff is very, very powerful and helpful for those people in their desperate need.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating topic, isn't it? And something we could definitely talk about all day, probably. And, you know, we'll talk about it again. That's the fact. And it's changing. It's you know, immense how quickly everything's evolving, isn't it? So, and I know, you know, I'm still the old fashioned kind of typing my letters, but the fact is AI is there, you know, for the change, and we can cut down our letters and do it on AI and stuff like that. You know, but you have to go with it and you know, accept change as well. Before we leave this amazing podcast, what is there any other key aspects that you've kind of read, Gretchen, or any other key aspects you'd like to say?
I just wanted to add a little bit about the flow neuroscience piece now that I've got the website up. Yes, it is actually, just to say, it's clinically proven depression treatment used by the NHS.
Oh, something I've not heard of then.
Yeah, backed by multiple independent clinical trials. There's been multiple NHS studies.
Mm-hmm.
Research shows that depression is linked to reduced activity in key areas of the brain. There's a non-invasive headset that is worn. So this is a wearable.
Okay.
And it helps to support the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex through when you're experiencing depression, the brain cells in this area become less active, disrupting your natural electrical communication or patterns. And this goes into the symptoms. So flow works with a natural electrical language, delivering precise calibrated stimulation. An equivalent of a battery is put in there, and the gentle current helps to restore healthy brain activity patterns and helps to relieve the symptoms of depression.
Oh, fascinating. Well, you know what? I'm going to be Googling after this podcast today.
Yeah, but this is so fascinating. And then there's, you know, mood tracking, you know, this is potentially a life-saving item, you know, and we don't all know about it, but it is available in the NHS.
Fabulous. Well, I think that's definitely one that I will be looking up after this podcast. Definitely. Definitely. Wow. Well, Gretchen, I can't thank you enough. We've been on quite a journey there. And I think we've both kind of, you know, have that feeling now where it, you know, AI will never replace a professional, but it definitely will be its little sidekick. Definitely. I can't thank you enough, Gretchen. You are very, very supportive of the BDNG. And the good news is for our listeners today, Gretchen will be doing a lot more work with us, and she will actually be face to face at the BDNG conference in 2026 in Harrogate. So we will be welcoming her with open arms there. So thank you, Gretchen. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. And I can't wait to see you all. And just, you know, I'm going to keep on going, helping you in every way I can. Thank you so much, Tina and the BDNG.
Yeah, actually, Gretchen, before we leave, we could do with an AI robot of you. So we've got the real one and the AI robot, and then we'll be all sorted.
Oh, bless you. Could you imagine? I don't think you would make one. I don't know. I think it's like glitch the system.
thanks again, Gretchen. And we will speak very soon.
Speak to you soon. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For further information on the BDNG, visit our website bdng.org.uk and watch out for the next BDNG podcast, which is coming soon.